I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases set for oral argument, but we've got some time between the first and the second one. Before I introduce the panel and call the first case, I wanted to note that we've got some students here in the audience, and so we always enjoy having students come and see what the Court of Appeals is all about. So, to my left, we have Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I'll be presiding on this panel today. So if the parties are ready for the first case, I will ask the clerk to call it. Okay, Mr. Campbell, if you're ready to proceed.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, my name is Casey Campbell on behalf of EMT Hope and AMR. And what this case involves is the applicability of Chapter 74 when it relates to an automobile accident where a patient alleges injury due to a car wreck while the patient was in the back of the ambulance receiving care.
Let me stop you right there because I've got a question.
Okay.
About her being a patient. So both sides have appendices that you've attached to your briefs that, as far as I can tell, it's not material that was in the clerk's record. So first of all, and this will be a question for both of you, I don't know how we can consider it, for one thing. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but in looking at the plaintiff's petition, she just said she was a passenger. And so your motion asserts that she was a patient, but there's no supporting evidence for that. So what are we supposed to do procedurally?
Some of the supporting evidence that I do believe is in the clerk's record are plaintiff's responses to requests for disclosure.
I did not see those in the clerk's record.
Okay. I'll double check.
Having already lost in this court on an eight corners rule argument where I argued for a healthcare defendant many years ago, probably a good 11, 12, 13 years ago, that we could go outside the record. My recollection is Justice Gardner stomped all over me and said we can't do that. In that instance, we were making an argument that the medical records themselves proved the exact opposite of what the expert report said, and the court held that it could not go outside the record. The difference here is there's no report. There's only four corners because we're dealing with pleadings, and so it's a different issue there. And so do we have any guidance from the Supreme Court as to how we're supposed to handle that? Is it an evidentiary? Is it a pleadings only type of thing? How are we to deal with that?
My understanding would be that it would be from the pleadings itself. Within the pleadings, I think in their factual assertions, they assert that the plaintiff called 911, to which my clients responded, and transported her to the hospital. I think just by virtue of context, that would make her a patient to these healthcare providers who are defined as healthcare providers under the code.
She may refer to herself as a passenger of the ambulance. The factual circumstances stated in the pleading would have indicated that the ambulance was responding to a health care situation.
Correct. And in fact, even in their pleadings, they assert that she called 911 due to either chest pain or shortness of breath, depending on which pleading. But regardless of which it is, it was a summoning for emergency help, and emergency health care providers are the ones who responded and are now the defendants in this case.
So I don't want to beat this up too badly, but I'm looking at the petition, I have to say I'm having trouble sort of putting blinders on, which I think we're obligated to do based on what's actually in the record as far as the Chapter 74 issue, because both sides have briefed this as though there's no dispute that she had called 911 and was a patient and all that sort of stuff, but if we're going to do what I think we're supposed to do, and like for you to create your rebuttable presumption that it's a health care liability claim, in looking at the petition, which I don't think was amended, I don't see anything in there about her calling 911. It just says in paragraph 7, this lawsuit results from an automobile collision that occurred, blah, blah, blah. Plaintiff Tabitha Stewart was a passenger in the emergency medical response van, and then your client was the driver traveling westbound, lost control, and hit a sidewall. So is there something else that you can point me to that's actually in the clerk's record where there's a pleading that she called 911 and was a patient?
I can point you to page 9 of their brief, their response brief, where she concedes that point.
Right, but that's my question. I mean, we're supposed to look at what's in the record, the trial court record. So that sort of goes back to what I was asking about at the beginning, because all the appendix information is not in the clerk's record.
I'll have to pull up the response to our motion to dismiss, but I believe it would be in there as well as a judicial admission those are the facts as asserted.
But you're not aware of anything in the clerk's records itself, is what you're saying, other than possibly that.
Other than that, or if I could be incorrect as far as the disclosures being in the clerk's record, where they list AMR as a medical provider.
Well, and that's sort of another more subtle question, I suppose, because in your reply to the plaintiff's response to your motion to dismiss, there's snippets from, looks like a screenshot from a couple of things that were in the medical records, or they're represented to be. Like, I'm looking at a clerk's record, pages 51 and 52, which is pages 2 and 3 of your reply. And so you represent in there that plaintiff had disclosed American Medical Response as plaintiff's medical provider in response to the disclosure request, but those weren't attached to the reply or to your motion. And then there, on the next page, there are snippets of interrogatory answers and something from the medical records. Is that enough without it being proved up by an affidavit or something? Is that enough, do you think, to give us the sort of evidence that the Supreme Court says we should look at in a Chapter 74 case?
I believe it would be, absent an objection, that there was no objection lodged to this as being considered by the trial court, and especially in light of the fact of the concessions that have been made since then, I would think that would be an adequate evidentiary record in order to make the decision, is she a patient?
Yeah. Of course, our job is to decide whether the trial court abused its discretion.
Correct.
In making its ruling, not what people are saying here on appeal, right?
Sure. And as far as the response or the record in the trial court, of no objection to that, and the response essentially conceding that she was a patient at the time, or that she was, or that we were responding to a 911 call. I think that all those factors together are enough to at least develop she's a patient, we are healthcare providers.
Mr. Campbell, I'm not an expert on Chapter 74 by any means. That's not really within the purview of what I've done in my career, but up until this point. But kind of backing up a little bit more, am I right in that in order for it to apply, obviously, there is a rebuttable presumption, but it's not just a rebuttable presumption that's just standing all the time. There's something that you, as a defendant, needed to do in order to invoke Chapter 74, correct?
Well, there's actually two parts to that, and one of the issues that we might be avoiding is, to be a claimant, you don't have to be a patient. So the rebuttable presumption comes up when it's a patient. We can skip that and say whether she's a patient or not, it doesn't matter. We can still do an analysis of healthcare liability claim. So no, we don't have to establish that she was a patient and in order to still be entitled to Chapter 74. We have to establish that she's a claimant, and as that's defined under 74001, she 100% is a claimant, and we are 100% healthcare providers. So If we want to waive the issue of rebuttable presumption and say that she has to overcome that, sure, we can do that. I was going to skip to the seven Ross factors anyway. The first argument that I would have is if she's a patient and we are a healthcare provider, then there is a rebuttable presumption that she has to overcome, and she hasn't. But if you want to ignore that, I'm fine with that, and we can skip to the analysis of does this claim itself meet the seven factors or any of the factors of the Ross test, which is what the other courts have all done. So whether or not she's a patient is honestly irrelevant to the ultimate decision. It only comes up if I'm trying to win on she didn't overcome the rebuttable presumption.
Well, now, if she had been seated in the front seat as a passenger just riding along, this wouldn't be a healthcare liability claim. Just riding in an ambulance doesn't make an injury suffered in an accident a healthcare liability claim. That's not what you're arguing, are you?
That's not what I'm arguing. It would still go through that.
So something, there has to be some connection with healthcare under the circumstances, okay? And she's riding in an ambulance, and there may be some circumstances with regard to healthcare with regard to that. She's asking questions about how do we know healthcare is involved in terms of the record. But, so patient status, someone receiving healthcare, arguably is something important to our analysis, would it not be?
Not necessarily, in the sense of if the facts established by the argument are that they meet those seven factors, whether she is a patient or whether she is not, if the court can determine from the record that when the injury occurred and answer those seven questions one way or the other, then whether she's declared a patient or not does not matter to the healthcare liability claim status.
So walk us through those seven factors and point us to the evidence that was before the trial court where any or all of those was established, or the pleadings.
The first is, did the alleged negligence of the defendant occur in the course of the defendant performing task with the purpose of protecting a patient from harm? Well, I can't point the court directly to any evidence as we sit here other than the judicial admissions of how this case has been argued from the outset and at the trial court level, with no objection to the assertion of facts in their response to our motion to dismiss, no dispute over was the plaintiff calling 911? Were we responding to it? The facts are the facts. I haven't seen anything where there's a dispute other than plaintiff characterizes it as a passenger. What the Supreme Court has been very clear on is you can't cleverly plead your way out of Chapter 74. And what the evidence I think that the court has enough of is to show is there's no dispute. She called 911. There's no dispute that we responded. Those are the facts. Whether or not there's an entry in the trial court level, that just issue never came up because it was conceded by both sides. There wasn't a dispute over did she call 911? Did we respond in that way? Because we go through those factors, and the factors would be, were we in the course of protecting the patient from harm? Of course, we were transporting her to the emergency department due to her call for emergency services. The next is, did the injuries occur in a place where the patient might be? During the time they were receiving care, of course, she was in the back of an ambulance receiving that care. At the time of the injury, was the claimant in the process of seeking or receiving health care? Absolutely. And again, I understand that we might not have the evidentiary record, but part of that is because the parties knew that that these were the facts, regardless of how they're...
But did the trial court know?
The trial court, I mean, of course, that was part of the argument at the trial court level, and was within both our motion to dismiss, their response and the reply. None of that was ever questioned. It was always known that those are the facts. She called 911, we responded, we were on the way to the hospital through an emergency transport when the accident occurred. So this wasn't a question of hiding the ball that we're suddenly coming out. It was an ambulance performing 911 response. One of the other issues is Chapter 74 has broadly defined what healthcare liability claim is. Even this court has said that a doctor who's deciding where AEDs go at a water park can be a healthcare liability claim in Yamada. So it's intended to be very broad and would certainly include these facts. While the trial court may not have had the evidentiary record that this court is looking for, it wasn't in dispute. It was all parties conceded that's what occurred. Miss Stewart called for emergency medical services. My clients provided those services. She was injured during the course of the provision of those services and is now suing for those injuries, which falls squarely within the definition of Chapter 74.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Magdalena Avila, and I represent Ms. Tabitha Stewart, and this was our passenger in the ambulance. In December of 2018, Ms. Stewart, she was having breathing problems. She's at home and just couldn't breathe. She's got a history of some medical issues, and she called 911. And the ambulance came, picked her up because of her breathing. They thought it'd be best for her to go to the hospital, which was fine. During the course of the trip to the hospital to be treated for breathing issues, we have a driver. Miss Hope is a driver, technician for the ambulance center. And then we have a second ambulance provider in the back with Miss Stewart, taking her to the hospital. I'm not an expert on Chapter 74 cases either, but do car accidents and our pleading, which is the record.
Let me ask you about your pleading, because none of what you just said is in your pleading. I mean, the petition just said she was a passenger. Doesn't say she called 911. Doesn't say she was in the back of the ambulance. Doesn't say she had breathing problems. Doesn't say anything like that. So, again, it's sort of the question that I had for Mr. Campbell. Y'all are saying a lot of stuff, but I'm having a hard time understanding what it was that Judge Rabel had before him when he heard the motion to dismiss.
And you're right. I will stay within just that original pleading, which is a standard negligence due to the failure to drive the rules, to follow the rules of the road, a basic standard car accident case pleading. There was no invocation on behalf of the plaintiff of any type of medical malpractice or Chapter 74 at all in the original pleading, which is the only thing that is out there.
Does your original pleading place her in an ambulance or a vehicle referred to that we can refer to as an ambulance?
She's a passenger in a medical emergency services vehicle wherein Hope was a technician driving her to the hospital.
Okay, and Hope is referred to as a technician?
I refer to her as a technician. That's what they refer to them as, the drivers of the ambulance.
Okay, it doesn't even say that she's going to the hospital. I mean, I'm looking at your petition. I don't know if you have it handy, but it says she was a passenger in the emergency medical response van, that Amber Hope was the driver, and there's nothing in there about where they're going, why she's in the van, who else is in there. I mean, so
right.
I'm just I'm just confused about what it is that both sides want us to look at.
I just want you to look at the
Chapter 74 case.
I just want you to look at the pleading before you. That is all we're alleging, negligence on a standard motor vehicle accident case where she's a passenger, driver hits a curve, and it causes injury to Ms. Stewart. I disagree with the invocation of the medical malpractice, Chapter 74, that she didn't have to be a patient or treatment, and then it goes into another world of Chapter 74 and Article 4590I on expert reports. The only thing we have before the court is a pleading on a standard motor vehicle accident case.
Well, what about, and here again, maybe there's no case law on this. I don't know. I haven't scrubbed the case law entirely, but I am curious because, as Mr. Campbell pointed out in his opening argument, in their reply to your response to the motion to dismiss, they did excerpt something from the medical records and apparently something from your disclosure response that wasn't objected to. Does that mean that we should consider that as the sort of evidence that, I mean, you know, because typically in these kind of cases you've got affidavits and you've got medical records attached to motions and responses and all that sort of stuff, and here we just don't have that.
The responses to our required disclosures, as plaintiffs, we list the providers and the records that we want to, recover for injuries for a client. In there, and it is a standard language, it'll say Dr. Smith, client's provider, you know, doctor, you know, chiropractic care, health care, because they received care. So our job is to list all the providers that she listed had care from. Yes, the American Medical Response is on there as a treatment provider because she has called them later on also because of her back problems that she sustained, not due to this particular call. So they will be on there as later providing a service for her for the injury she sustained as a result of the motor vehicle accident.
Let's assume for right now that we can take into account the concessions that, in fact, she had chest pain, she called 911, the ambulance responded, she's in the back of the ambulance being taken care of by the other EMT, and Ms. Hope is the EMT driving the car. Why is the transport of a patient who is in the process of being stabilized for further treatment at a hospital, why is that not healthcare related within the meaning of Chapter 74?
And so there, the healthcare liability claim is defined as a cause of action against a healthcare provider or physician for treatment, lack of treatment, or other claimed departure from accepted standards of medical care or health care or safety or professional or administrative services directly related to health care. And that is our Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Chapter 74. The deviation from the standard of care is what should have caused her to be injured, to fall under Chapter 74.
Well, I'm sorry. But the defendants, the appellants have cited a couple of cases, City of Houston versus Hussein, City of Houston versus Houston, I think there's one or two more, and one out of this court where the act of being transported, you know, whether you're strapped in or you're not strapped in or whatever, and there's an accident, falls under the safety aspect. And so how would you distinguish their authority that seems to be pretty clearly on point that it is a Chapter 74 claim?
I see that. And Ms. Stewart is not alleging a departure from accepted standards of medical care or health care or safety. The second element of the health care liability claim is that it must be about the patient's treatment, lack of treatment, or some other departure from the standard of the medical care or health care safety. The plaintiff's claim of departure from standards of safety did not directly relate to health care. We related directly to the departure of safety and transportation in driving and following the rules of the world, of the road. We believe the defendant's employees were negligent and failed to meet the applicable standards of care with respect to transportation and following the rules of the road.
Gets back to my question, which is Chapter 74 clearly incorporates Chapter 773 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. And that deals with emergency medical services, which arguably includes the transport of patients with regard to that. So if Chapter 74 is incorporating that chapter and incorporating the healthcare personnel, emergency medical services personnel, as healthcare providers and or individuals who are subject to Chapter 74, why would we not include transport as part of the safety that is involved in providing those emergency medical services?
And that is where Article 4590I, Section 103, Section 3, defines the healthcare provider. What is a healthcare provider? And it actually provides a list. And it's a person, partnership, professional association, corporation, facility, or institution duly licensed or chartered by the state of Texas to provide health care as a registered nurse, hospital, dentist, podiatrist, pharmacist, or nursing home, or an officer, employee, or agent thereof acting in the course and scope of his employment. It specifically, so this act, the definition specifically delineates entities that are healthcare providers, including hospitals and nursing homes. An ambulance company is not one of those specifically listed. And that's also where we come in then and start talking about the nexus and the correlation of then, this is kind of, I call it the gray area, and that's one of the articles that we rely on, that the ambulance service is not specifically listed as a healthcare provider.
And yet there are multiple cases out there where it's the same facts, essentially, and it is found to be a healthcare liability claim.
Right, and that's where the nexus that we were talking about earlier comes into play into, was there a deviation of that standard of care while she was being treated? She was not being treated by Ms. Hope, who was in the front driving the vehicle.
How do you distinguish this case from Hussein?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. This
Hussein case. How do you distinguish this case from the Hussein case, where I believe it was Dallas said that it was a healthcare liability claim with regard to the transport of an ambulance?
And I don't have that case right in front of me, but the one that I did refer to in our brief is a Townsend case that did say that the transport of a patient, I have it right over here. The Townsend case versus Kelly holding that an emergency ambulance service is not a health care provider for purposes of Article 4590I. So you have.
I think Townsend, though, predated the enactment of Chapter 74, which didn't come into place until 2003, 2004. So I'm not sure that that case really carries forward to the present. But the Hussein case that the appellant cited in their brief, you know, is one that's more modern, and it does seem to be pretty.
To talk about that,
yes.
And there was the case also.
Did Judge Rabel give any? Was do you recall whether Hussein was actually cited to Judge Rabel during the hearing?
I don't recall Hussein being cited during Rabel's hearing.
Lightness when he gets up for rebuttal, but I would be interested if, in fact, it was discussed with Judge Rabel, how Judge Rabel decided he was going to not follow that case from a distinction standpoint.
So the one issue that we have there on the required disclosures as to why it is listed as a provider, we have listed the providers that gave her care. It is not necessarily listed for purposes of this transport, but there was some transport down the line in her care for the injury sustained. I wanted to clarify that point since that was, I think, one of the things that we talked about. And then the record that we have was just the pleading that we hold to based on what we have of the original petition and our response that that we just feel that the mere act of transporting a person who's to receive health care does not directly or necessarily relate or constitute providing a patient treatment, lack of treatment, or involve some departure from accepted standards of the medical or health care of safety within the meaning of Chapter 74 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Court. Plaintiff Stewart is not alleging a departure from these standards of medical care or health care safety or has alleged any of that in her original pleading. And we feel that it should not be, cannot and should not be categorized as a health care liability claim simply because plaintiff claimed defendant's employee departed from the applicable standards of care with respect to the transportation of Ms. Stewart. And therefore, that's why we feel she's not required to provide an expert report and that it...
Counselor, let me cut it real fast. I get what you're saying, and I understand your position. And obviously, the response that they're always going to argue is artful pleading is not going to get you around 74. And with all due respect, when I read your brief, it's kind of conclusory. And then it's just like, well, 74 just doesn't apply. And the problem we have, I think, is what you're gleaning is there are some cases that says that it does. And I understand you can't necessarily remember which ones by name, but what's unique about these facts in your case that makes these cases that seemingly say that it's on point and applies not applicable? What do you have anything that you can tell us that's unique? And let me, I may even be able to help you a little bit. I don't know. But, you know, going back to what is the act that you're alleging is negligent? Is it driving? Is it medical care? I mean, is there anything unique about that? Is there something there that you can?
There's nothing unique about the negligence that we're alleging is just straightforward negligence on the failing to maybe not, you know, hit the curb, not, you know, evasive action, what have you, which involves just negligence of the rules of transporting.
Talking about driving.
Of driving, just driving. That's all we're alleging. And there is case law out there on, I understand what you're saying, and I've read quite a few and relied on some. There are a lot where they do apply because there are people that die in an ambulance where they're actually being treated. There is a case that I was just reading one this morning that I have out there where there was a whole issue, again, whether it applies or not on a person almost dying and whether that treatment given in the ambulance is that difference between surviving or not. If they suctioned enough and this person suffocated and they were actually hands-on life or death situation, treating this person. And I think what's the difference is they were transporting her to the hospital for breathing problems that she's had for a while so that she could get further care. In fact, it's not part of the record, I'll say it, but it wasn't even like code red or lights and siren, they were transporting her. I think that really makes a difference that the person, the technician that was in the back with Ms. Stewart was also hurt. So it's quite a jolt on it. There was no CPR or emergency care treatment needed there for her survival to get to that hospital. It was more of a transport. And there is a little bit of a difference there. An ambulance ride can potentially save your life and make the difference between living or surviving by the time you get to the ambulance. And other times, it just needs to get you to some health care where they're not there's not going to be that treatment that's going to be the difference of whether you survive or not. And our stand is this is a motor vehicle collision. There was not a matter of life or death. She was transported. The decision was made. They allowed her to get ready and transport her to the hospital. And I don't know if that answered that question, but that is such a difference there on what we classify as treatment, and does it actually come now into the nitty-gritty of 4590I of, is it a patient? What was going on? Well, the injury she sustained was her neck and back. It had nothing to do with why she was going to the hospital to begin with. It was just a little bit of careless and reckless disregard for the rules of the road is what we're alleging in our petition.
There's some ambiguity in the record about whether or not she was strapped down or whether or not she said she was strapped down and all that. And, of course, there's some case law out there from our court that actually says in an instance where a patient wasn't strapped down that 74 applied. But I believe in a deposition she said that was not an issue at all. But does the court even have that as a part of the record? Did they even consider that aspect and making their decision on this motion to dismiss?
One of the things about this case is it's so early on. Really, the only thing we filed was a original petition in the required disclosures. There is no depositions. There are a lot of medical records on a lot of time, a lot of medical records. She's never claiming our petition, never said that she was improperly strapped in there.
But the trial court didn't have those medical records before it, correct?
Correct. And I'm going to, Your Honor, if I may say they may have, because required disclosures are filed, but the records are actually not attached to the responses, unless counsel made those available too. But there's a lot of what doctors' notes taken in, but there is absolutely no evidence, a recorded statement or a deposition or any of that sort from Ms. Stewart saying I was improperly strapped.
Okay. Thank you. Your time.
Thank you.
But before you start your rebuttal, I just have one quick question. Do we possibly have an incomplete clerk's record, or as far as you know, did the clerk prepare everything that the trial court had before it that we now seek? It's a very slim clerk's record.
I believe it's an incomplete record because my recollection is I filed an amended answer before the motion to dismiss, but I would have to go back and double check that. I'm not sure.
We have a reporter's record?
We do have a reporter's record.
Okay, so we have on the hearing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And something that you can possibly...
Well, no, I don't think I think it's too late for that
at this point,
but I don't know. Anyway, I was just curious because there's been so much talk about the medical records and all that kind of stuff that I was just curious whether you had a recollection whether the trial court actually had some pleading or something in front of it that had all these records attached, but I'm thinking probably not. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
To the extent that portions of those records were included in our reply, the court certainly had that in front of it, that to that extent. And Justice Birdwell, to answer your question about Hussein, the judge did have that discussion about Hussein. In fact, that was kind of how we closed the hearing, was he asked us to provide a copy of it, which we did that afternoon. The next thing we know, we got the denial. So I'm not sure what the reasoning was for that.
There wasn't any discussion with him with regard to it. Okay.
The discussion was, there's a case directly on point that has almost identical facts, and he asked us to provide it, and that was that.
Have any of the cases that we've had placed before us dealt with this notion that there doesn't appear to be, even if we take into consideration everything that's been discussed, any dispute that this was hitting a curb? That there doesn't appear to be anything with regard to actual health care. This is purely a transport, negligence in the transport, and the negligence that's being alleged has absolutely nothing to do with the actual provision of health care in the hospital, in the ambulance, but solely with regard to how the ambulance was being driven at the time. And could you tell me a little bit about how Hussein dealt with that, if it did?
Sure, and that's exactly what happened in Hussein. It was that the ambulance struck the sidewall curb of a toll booth as it was going through and, quote, tossed the patients. In what I've learned by going through some of those pleadings, it didn't mean tossed out of the ambulance. It meant jostled inside. So it's almost identical facts as to what happened here, where the court said, the interesting thing about Hussein is there were actually two claimants, and the court ultimately said the one who was a patient is a healthcare liability claim, the one who was not a patient is not, that they applied the Ross factors differently to those two individuals. So when it comes to someone like Ms. Stewart, it's a healthcare liability claim for almost identical facts.
Yeah, but isn't there's whether it's stated directly or it's just implied, there is some allegation that there was an improper strapping inside the ambulance in Houston.
I don't believe that's correct.
Because we could infer it, at least if they're being jostled inside the back of an ambulance, we can infer that there was a problem with how they were strapped down. So you have that problem coupled with driving.
Sure, and most likely, sure. If we're going to take implications, I think that we can apply that across the board. And if we take their petition, we can even imply where they say that Ms. Stewart was a passenger in the emergency medical response van and that defendant Terry Hope was the driver of the emergency medical response van. I think we can take that implication and say, obviously, and then, sorry,
let me. It
would
be the same way here, in other words.
Right. It would be the same thing of, they also alleged that she was acting within the course and scope of her employment of an emergency medical service provider while driving that van. I think we can take those implications to say she's providing health care to this lady who is a patient.
Let me ask you a question, because I know your time is kind of coming up. But so here's the deal with Chapter 72 that I'm trying to get my head around. You have a situation where you have to have an expert report, and it has to be from a physician. But the act that's being alleged in this case is not actually medical treatment, it's driving. And so, in essence, it seems like what we're being told is Chapter 72, the reason this should be tossed is because there was an expert report filed by a physician, but physicians aren't experts on how to drive a vehicle. And so it seems somewhat circular, and I'm still figuring this out. Is there something you can tell me to help me understand that? Because if they had filed an expert report from an ambulance driver, this would have been tossed because it wouldn't have been from a physician.
Sure.
I know your time's up, but you could.
I'll give you 60 seconds to answer that question and wrap up.
No problem. So the way this works is they would actually have to file two expert reports, one from an EMS, EMT, paramedic, driver, whoever, saying what the standard of care is. The physician is only required for causation. So they would say that addresses that. It happens when I represent physical therapists, they have to have a physical therapist provide the standard of care and then a rehabilitation physician provide the other report. It's certainly doable. It's done in 50% of my cases that aren't physician-based defendants.
And your attack was, in this case, neither were filed.
Correct. And to answer the second part of your question, had they just filed one by the physician, that they actually would have gotten a second opportunity. They would have 30 days to cure in order to provide one by EMS. So that's another distinguishment of how they can. It's not so circular after all.
Okay.
Did I get your time limit?
You still got 23 seconds.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Counselor. The oral argument was very helpful, and your case is now submitted, and we will stand adjourned until 2:30.